From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we'll talk about what it means when a city issues 2,500 pink slips.
I mean, the city of Oakland's government is not bloated. At this point, you're just depriving citizens of services.
Oakland's redevelopment woes. We'll also find out why the biodegradable fork you threw away at lunch might actually end up in a landfill.
So it's not recyclable, it's not compostable, it's worse for the landfill, just as bad as litter. There's no benefit to its end of life. It's a greenwash, and don't waste your money on it.
And we'll learn why werewolves aren't just for Halloween anymore.
If you think about it, these legends have existed for centuries, and I think every child that goes to camp tells ghost stories around the campfire in the middle of July.
That and more coming up on Cross Currents. Imagine for a minute that you're Governor Jerry Brown. You're in Sacramento trying to pass a budget that will shrink the state's deficit to only $9 billion. You're pressured to save school budgets and deal with prison realignment, that touchy and expensive stuff, when suddenly you get the news. The Supreme Court has given you a gift, a $1.7 billion gift. Yes, the state could be seeing all of that money, and soon, since a California court ruled in favor of shutting down more than 400 redevelopment agencies. Good for balancing the state's budget? Yes. But the collateral damage? Low-income housing projects stuck in limbo? Revitalization projects at a standstill? So now cities and counties are scrambling to figure out how to deal with the loss of these agencies on February 1st. With the loss of state redevelopment funds, the city of Oakland loses about $28 million. And as Mayor Gene Kwan said in a press conference yesterday, that means big changes.
We realized that we just couldn't cut in the regular way. You trim a little bit here, a little bit there. We had been planning to, and this now speeds up to reorganize the city, to merge departments, to cut administrative levels, to look at how we could do things differently. And that's basically what we've done here. We've not just made the redevelopment cuts, but we've reorganized so that we could save public services and the staff that supports them to the largest extent possible.
That's Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan. Still, after issuing 2,500 pink slips to city employees last week, she says more than 100 will probably not be invited back to work. The final cuts are scheduled to be announced next week. To talk about how this will affect the city of Oakland, we're joined now by Robert Gammon, co-editor of the East Bay Express. First off, Robert, I'm wondering why Oakland seems to be so deeply affected by the loss of its redevelopment funds.
Well, redevelopment has become an important part of the city over the past 10 years, especially during Mayor Jerry Brown's administration. The city, under his direction and the city council's direction, decided to expand redevelopment throughout Oakland. The whole idea was that Oakland has many areas of deep poverty, and those areas need to be redeveloped. They need to attract new businesses, especially more housing into the area, affordable housing. And so the best way to do that in California is to create redevelopment areas so that you can take the tax revenues that are generated in those areas and then use it to reinvest back into the economy. For Oakland, it also means having to hire people to manage that process. And so the city of Oakland has 150 to 200 employees who have been managing that process throughout the city over the past decade. And so those people are going to be laid off with the elimination of redevelopment.
Are there any benefits to shrinking the city government at this point?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the city of Oakland's government is not bloated. It's been cut back drastically over the past several years through numerous rounds of budget cuts. And so at this point, you're just depriving citizens of services.
Statewide redevelopment agencies accrued a $30 billion debt. Was the money in Oakland being well spent in your estimation?
Some of it was and some of it wasn't. I mean, there were some projects that have been questionable over the years. But also, the redevelopment has paid for Jerry Brown's 10K plan, which brought, 10,000 new residents into the downtown area. It's revitalized in the uptown area and, created a whole new entertainment district with a refurbishment of the Fox Theater. So it's done a lot of good. It's also paid for a lot of affordable housing in Oakland, which has much needed.
And that was something that Jerry Brown really supported when he was mayor of Oakland.
Yes. I mean, he understood the power of what redevelopment could do. In fact, when I was doing a story a number of years ago about one of his redevelopment projects, which is the Forest City apartment project, you know, I asked him, you know, is this really worth $50 million in public subsidies for redevelopment? He said, yes, it is, because this project will help turn around an area. And, you know, I was skeptical at the time, but over time, he was proven to be correct.
It seems that in a city like Oakland, where there are a lot of different projects that government needs to invest in order to bring the neighborhoods up, this is going to have not only a short-term effect of the loss of jobs now, but a real long-term effect because investment isn't happening.
That's very true. You know, another aspect that's kind of being missed here is that, you know, Oakland, because of its long industrial history, has many brownfields in the city. This is, you know, sites that have been polluted with toxic chemicals over years of use, and they are just sitting there, still toxic. And redevelopment was a key way to clean up these areas. And without redevelopment funds, it's unclear whether that's going to happen. So this is environmental impacts as well.
Robert Gammon is editor at the East Bay Express. The North Oakland District will be holding an emergency budget meeting tonight at 7 p.m. at the North Oakland Senior Center. You can find more information on our website. It's kalw.org. It's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Finding ways to save money is of paramount importance in Oakland. For many people in the Bay Area, that goes along with the need to find ways to save the planet. This season's late rains are the latest evidence of climate change. National efforts to improve gas mileage and local regulations on petroleum-based plastic bags have led consumers to other options, including compostable plastics.
Okay, it's about compostable plastics. I'm wondering if you guys know what's in these.
I don't.
You don't know?
No.
I think it was potatoes. Starches.
Is it cornstarch?
I don't know what they're made of.
I have no idea. I use them for picking out my dog. So.
Is it made of corn?
Is it potato?
I assume they're made of corn.
They're made out of corn, right?
Those are some consumers outside of Byright in San Francisco. And as you heard, once you get past the word compost, our knowledge of what's actually in those spoons gets a little fuzzy. KALW's Hadley Robinson has more.
The Sonoma Compost Company is just off Highway 101, northwest of Petaluma. All day, trucks haul in plant materials and haul out soil.
This here is our standard Sonoma compost, and this here is our high test that has was composted with the chicken feathers and has a 2.5% nitrogen in it, so it's great for vegetable growing.
Will Bax operates the compost facility, and to his mind, those incoming trucks are carrying two types of things. There's plant material and food scraps from kitchens and yards across Sonoma County. That's what the trucks are supposed to be carrying. Then there's what they're not supposed to be carrying.
Yeah, look at all that plastic, huh?
Yeah, it's a real problem.
Bax has been operating the Petaluma facility for 26 years. It processes about 300 tons of green waste a day. That's about 1,000 pickup trucks full. In the last few years, though, Bax and his crew have noticed an increasing amount of what's known as compostable plastic.
We have over here about 5 to 6 people working on it at the sorting before it goes in the grinder. And then I have still 1 to 2 people cleaning up between the windrows out here of compost.
Here's the thing. Bax doesn't take plastics, not any plastics. Instead, his employees spend lots of time picking out those supposedly compostable forks and bags and throwing them in the trash.
Whenever the window turner goes through it, it kind of pushes the plastic to the outside, and so we rake that up again.
That's right. If you dropped it in the compost bin in Sonoma County, the compostable fork you felt so good about using probably went to the landfill. Bax explains that when compost includes plastics, the resulting soil isn't considered organic. That means it can't be sold to organic farmers.
It is extremely effective in consumer confidence when they see that you go through the efforts of making it meet the standards for organic growing. It really enhances the confidence they have in these materials.
Apart from wanting to stay organic, Bax has a lot of hesitation about compostable plastics. He says they used to be made exclusively from plants, but that's changed as the industry has grown.
on a lot of products you will not see anymore that it says corn or potato, because they make compostable plastics out of oil-derived material right now too. And so a lot of these compostable plastics are, some of them, 100% petroleum-based.
How can a compostable thing be petroleum-based?
The molecular structure is such that the microbes can consume it.
In other words, it isn't identical to oil, but it's derived from it. The city of San Francisco sees plastics in its compost differently.
There's almost no difference between a corn cob going in on one end with a corn cup and both coming out as finished compost.
Jack Macy is the city's commercial zero waste coordinator. Like a growing number of cities, San Francisco is trying to divert as much waste from landfills as possible. A plastic that is fully compostable, meaning it can be consumed by organisms within 180 days, achieves that goal. So San Francisco will take any plastic that meets this compostability standard, no matter what it's made from. Macy does have some concerns, mostly about consumer confusion. Companies like Coca-Cola now offer plastic bottles that they advertise as plant-based. They're not compostable, but the big green leaf on the logo might make you think otherwise.
Well, because it's plant-based, it actually doesn't change the final chemistry of that bottle, and it's just as a durable, non-degradable plastic as if it was made from petroleum. So it is not compostable or degradable in any meaningful sense.
Macy's other concern is over labeling.
So if you see the word degradable or biodegradable on a product, you should be very wary and not consider it compostable and really not use it.
Under a 2008 California law, plastics can't be labeled biodegradable and can only be labeled compostable if they meet specific standards, like completely breaking down within 6 months. Even so, many companies use the word biodegradable freely. This past October, Attorney General Kamala Harris put some teeth in the legislation, filing suit against three water bottle companies for mislabeling. Macy says consumers shouldn't let themselves be tricked.
To the extent that it might break down, it's even worse in a landfill. So it's not recyclable, it's not compostable, it's just as bad as litter. There's no benefit to its end of life. It's a greenwash, and don't waste your money on it.
There's a lot of money at stake here. Plastics that meet the compostable standard are more expensive. At Costco, 1,000 compostable forks cost nearly $65, while 1,000 regular plastic forks are $37. Will Bax of Sonoma Compost says this makes it even more important for people to know exactly what they're buying.
For the consumer, it's very important because they are paying extra money for these products. And, you know, it's like, are they just wasting it? I mean, literally taking it to the landfill? Or is it a good thing that they're doing it?
Bax also questions the whole concept of growing plastic from plants, just to turn it back into soil.
All the embedded energy of making it, growing the corn, which is a heavy fertilizer, it has a heavy pesticide, use a heavy water user, then it needs to be processed, then there's the transportation. All of that energy is destroyed in the composting process.
And at that point, he says, composting those plastics might not even be worth it.
I would definitely look more at recycling them than composting them.
Every day we make decisions based on our environmental values. A wooden stirrer or a reusable spoon to mix your to-go coffee. Organic vegetables or local ones. We want the decisions to be straightforward, but sometimes they're not.
I think that people come from a good place. They, you know, it's like I think that most of us here, particularly the Bay Area, feel that whatever we can do to make a better environment, we are willing to pay a little extra for that. And so when you see compostable plastic, everyone knows that compost is good for the earth. Naturally, we think that we're doing the right thing.
The U.S. Composting Council is studying the impacts of compostable plastics. So in a few years, we may see new standards for what that term means. But for now, with everybody eager to save the earth, it's composters like Will Bax who are left holding the proverbial compostable trash bag. For Cross Currents, I'm Hadley Robinson.
Do you have more questions about composting? We'll try to help you answer them. Leave us your questions on our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Again, that's 415-264-7106. We could air your question and our answer in an upcoming show. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Composting is just one way we're thinking about reducing waste, and when it works, we notice. Landfills slim down and gardens bulk up. But then there's the waste that doesn't take up space, like energy. A collective in San Francisco's Mission District called Civil Twilight has an answer to the amount of streetlight that we waste every night when the sun goes down. In this episode of 99% Invisible, we explore a sustainable future through the night sky.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
Sustainability is.
Well, I think for a lot of people, sustainability is an abstract thing, and as such, it's hard to sort of engage on it on the emotional level. It's really needed to push things forward. We want to inspire people rather than creating guilt trips or making them look at numbers.
Sustainability is something that can be powerful and experiential and impact your life.
My name is Anton Willis. I'm a designer and part of a studio called Civil Twilight.
Civil Twilight's flagship project is Lunar Resonant Streetlights.
These are streetlights that sense and respond to ambient moonlight.
So they dim and brighten in response to the lunar cycle.
When the moon is full, they dim down to save energy. It's both a way of saving energy and creating a new urban connection to the cycle of the moon.
The project won the 2007 Metropolis Next Generation Design Competition partly because it took this huge design challenge of trying to curb energy use and added a bit of the poetic, a design that saves energy but also inspires and reconnects urban dwellers with one of the fundamental cycles of nature.
In most cities today, the level of light pollution is so high that we're really not aware of the stars or moonlight at all. You know, no one knows what phase of the moon it is on any given day. So we're looking for a way to really reconnect people to those kinds of cycles.
Each individual light has a very sensitive photo sensor that picks up moonlight, cloud cover, atmospheric conditions.
So on the scale of a city, you could actually have really interesting phenomena. If a cloud passed over the moon, you could sort of see a shimmering across the city, reflecting the kind of cloud shadow. We see it as a pretty amazing way to make cities as a whole more responsive and sort of more dynamic and more alive. Turns out that in the early years of street lighting, both gas and electricity was really expensive, so they only turned them on when they needed to. And they typically would not turn them on full moonlit nights when it was clear out. People just had the understanding that that was enough light to see by in cities, and it was a waste of energy to light on top of that.
And that really changed with the national grid electrification in the 1930s.
When they actually needed a way to burn off excess energy at night when no one was using electricity in their homes. And the streetlight grid actually began as a way to do that as much as a way to illuminate cities.
And since then, almost every city has to be illuminated very brightly 24 hours a day.
The standards for lighting that are in place come out of that period.
So this is an effort to make a beautiful, energy-efficient version of a thing designed and used historically to burn energy on purpose.
I think we've gotten used to talking about sustainability in terms of a lot of metrics and numbers and less about people's direct experience of it. So we're looking at ways to really bring it to a tangible, personal, experiential level. We see ourselves as part of a stronger direction that the whole sustainability movement will go, we believe, in the coming years.
So where's my friendly neighborhood moon-responsive streetlight? Well, so far it only exists as a prototype. So far. MIT labs are also prototyping a similar in spirit indoor adaptive lighting system as a massive energy-saving technology, but also as a way to make our working environments more comfortable, productive, and pleasing through using more natural and responsive light.
I think a lot of the current design discussion is about how to make design more relevant, how to make it part of these processes that really shape the world, the economics, the government, all of the sort of processes that we don't think of being designed or having a relationship to design. Climate change is a design problem. You know, the national debt is a design problem. All of these things are design problems in different ways if you expand the scope of how you think about it a little bit. Our challenge as designers is really to expand that scope and to become part of bigger discussions.
Sustainability is.
99% Invisible is produced by Roman Mars with support from Lunar. It's a project of KALW, the American Institute of Architects San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. To hear more, go to 99%invisible.org. Find a link at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that leaves you howling with delight. Vampires and werewolves have their biggest season at Halloween, but they're always with us. Every full moon for the werewolves, and every dark of the moon for the vampires. If you don't believe it, go to a movie theater, play a video game, or look in the young adult section of the library or bookstores.
No measure of time with you would be long enough. But we'll start with forever.
The possessed and undead souls featured in the Twilight Saga books and their stylish movie adaptations may currently have teens transfixed, but the idea of these creatures walking among us dates back to at least the time of ancient Greece, where the man-wolf was called Lycanthropos. Lycanthropos is also the name of a performance of stories and period music planned for next Sunday in Albany. KALW's Stephen Short chose a bright sunny day to talk with the presenter about werewolves, an idea that will not die.
Multi-instrumentalist Tim Rayborn of Berkeley knows a thing or two about werewolves. He's been studying them in preparation for his evening of story and song next Sunday. But Tim, this is late January. Shouldn't you have planned this for Halloween?
Not really, no. I think it's a funny thing that everyone always associates stories of vampires and ghosts and werewolves and such with Halloween. But if you think about it, these legends have existed for centuries, and I think every child that goes to camp tells ghost stories around the campfire in the middle of July.
And while Rayborn says these legends have existed for centuries, he could just as easily say for millennia.
Even if you look at the ancient cave paintings in Lhasa and the ancient prehistoric cave paintings from 18 to 20,000 years ago, there are human-animal hybrids. There are people that may be shamans wearing deer antlers and such. So this idea of a kind of union between the animal world and the human world has probably been around as long as we've been human.
In other words, it's in our blood. Rayborn's program of Tales in Music is his contribution to this year's early music series presented by Music Sources, based in Berkeley. This year's theme is Music in Central Europe, fertile ground for tales of vampires and werewolves. Here's a soundbite from one of Rayborn's selections.
Called The Lay of Bisclavre by Marie de France from the late 12th century. Among the tales I tell, I would not forget the lay of the werewolf. Such beasts are known in every land. Bisclavre he is named in Brittany, while the Normans call him Garwal. Many have suffered this change and run wild in the woods as a werewolf. The werewolf is a fearsome beast. He lurks within the thick forest, horrible to see. All the evil that he may do, he does. Listen now to the adventure of the werewolf that I have to tell.
While werewolves may be eternal, Rayborn notes that human perceptions of these shape-shifting creatures have a way of assuming different forms themselves. In ancient times, they inspired fear and terror.
But it, in the Middle Ages, curiously enough, and we would tend to think of the Middle Ages as awash in superstition, most of the werewolf stories in the Middle Ages, the werewolves are tragic figures. They're noble human beings who are cursed to take on this form against their will. And several of the stories I'm doing in my program actually discuss this.
This perception of werewolves, tragically romantic figures that just can't help themselves, is back in fashion today. But in the Renaissance, following the Dark Ages, werewolves reverted to being a source of fear again.
And they become these foul, evil monsters. It's very interesting how it morphed over time into different perceptions of what these creatures were.
The moon will be less than half full the evening of Rayborn's concert. This is good because there is no known defense against werewolves. But perhaps Tim Rayborn is providing the best antidote, a compound of historical knowledge combined with music, which is long known to soothe the savage beast. In Berkeley, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Lycanthropos, the werewolf in story and song, will be performed Sunday evening at St. Albans Episcopal Church in Albany, starting at 7 p.m. A link to this and all our stories can be found at kalw.org.
Look, Scott, werewolves are people just like anyone else. Being what we are is not without its problems, but it's not all bad either.
Tell me about it.
Well, for one thing, you're going to be able to do a lot of things the other guys aren't.
Oh, like chase cars and bite the mailman?
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Atyoms Konohovs, Taylor Lautner, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Holly Kernan is our news director. Cross Currents theme music is provided by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. Also, thanks to City Carshare. It provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org, and thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll explore an industry that has thousands of young women donating a piece of themselves to create someone else.
Well, that's what the doctor said yesterday, that I was their superstar, the goose with the golden eggs.
It's the Diary of an Egg Donor, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing is being performed by Bay Area native Nathan Chan. The 18-year-old, who's being compared with Yo-Yo Ma, will be performing 3 cello works with the Marin Symphony next Tuesday. The performance takes place at the Marin Center in San Rafael, starting at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. ¶¶